President Cyril Ramaphosa has described the Government of National Unity as a strategic move to advance the National Democratic Revolution. What could this mean in the long term for former opposition parties like the Democratic Alliance? We asked David Coulthard, a former minister in Robert Mugabe's Government of National Unity, to share some of the lessons learned in Zimbabwe. Welcome, Mr. Coulthard.
Great being with you, Chris.
Sir, how did ZANU-PF use the Government of National Unity in Zimbabwe to hollow out the opposition and become stronger than ever?
They worked very cynically. Right at the outset, of course, they were supported by President Mbeki, who enabled them to retain what we term the coercive ministries. They kept defense, they kept control of the judiciary, they kept control of the electoral process, the police, and all the main instruments of power in the country. And although the opposition MDC had some significant ministries, such as finance, they never really ever got close to controlling the levers of power. And so whilst the country was stabilized during the almost 5 years of the GNU, particularly in the ministries that the MDC controlled, finance, education, health, and the like, ZANU didn't yield a centimeter of their actual coercive power. And so when it came to the next election, the 2013 election, they had control over the police, over the army, they had control over the media, they had control over the electoral process. In fact, they had almost total effective control over the country. And they used that to great effect to subvert that election in 2013, undermine the opposition in the process, and retain absolute power.
And then they traded on the good performance of the opposition, former opposition ministers in that GNU, did they not?
Well, of course. So I was Minister of Education. When I started as Minister of Education, we had 8,000 schools still closed. We had 110,000 teachers on strike. The public examinations, which had been written the previous November, hadn't even been marked yet when I took over in February 2009. So we had an absolutely chaotic situation prevailing in education. By the end of the 5 years, we had all the teachers back at work, all the schools operating. We had textbooks on a one-to-one ratio, one textbook for every subject, for every child. As I say, all the schools operating, 15,000 more teachers back in, and the education sector stabilized. So ZANU benefited from that. And the same applied to finance. With finance, we got the country down to single-digit inflation. The economy grew in two of the years of the inclusive government by over 10%. And it took this thing out of the situation. If you look at the South African elections, the reason the ANC did so badly was because people were suffering, particularly people on the periphery. By 2013, people were no longer suffering in the country as they had been in the previous election, 2008. And so they didn't have the same cause to vote for the opposition. And that sentiment, combined with ZANU absolutely controlling the media, absolutely controlling the judiciary and the electoral process, meant that they were able to dominate the electoral process.
So what advice do you have for the Democratic Alliance and other former opposition parties in South Africa's Government of National Unity to avoid the same fate?
Let me make this point, that there are obvious differences between what prevailed in Zimbabwe between 2009 and 2013. In many respects, I think the MDC was at a huge disadvantage compared to the DA. For a start, the MDC was split into two factions and neither faction was particularly well organized, whereas the DA strikes me as being a disciplined, well-organized party. So there are these fundamental differences. But I think there are some lessons to be learnt by the DA. And the one critical thing is that despite that subverted playing ground, the MDC actually contributed to their their own downfall through some of their actions. So, for example, MDC ministers quickly assimilated themselves into the ZANU-PF method of operation. There were all the temptations of Mercedes Benz's. Morgan Tsvangirai, as prime minister, took a new luxurious house. And so in the mind of the electorate, in the eyes of the electorate, by the end of those 5 years, most MDC ministers couldn't easily be distinguished from your average ZANU-PF minister. It looked to many of the electorate that we had just been bought, and that, quite frankly, there was no incentive to vote for the MDC compared to ZANU-PF, because amongst many in the electorate, the feeling was that quite frankly, we were no different. We were in there for the goodies that we could get out of the office, not to try and bring about real change. So that was number one. We assimilated ourselves. Secondly, I think that we were naive. If I take myself, for example, I threw myself into education, which was the right thing to do, but I did so to the exclusion, for example, of taking more of an interest in the constitutional reform process that was going on. And whilst undoubtedly I and other MDC ministers were successful in our particular ministries, we did so at quite a cost. And that is that we spent so much time, for example, in education, that little time was spent on trying to tackle issues like the uneven playing field in the electoral environment, trying to, let's speak about the Fourth Estate, speaking out more vigorously regarding the lack of independence of the media, speaking out regarding the lack of independence of the judiciary. And so by the time the 2013 elections came, although we were running our own ministry successfully, we had naively allowed ZANU-PF, as I say, in a very cynical fashion, to consolidate their power. And so applying that to South Africa, the DA, the IFP, they need to demonstrate some savvy. It's a balance. Obviously, they've got to deliver effectively on their own ministries so that they can demonstrate to the electorate in South Africa that they are competent and inspire confidence. And that needs to be their dominant responsibility, but they must not ever do that at the cost of allowing the ANC to consolidate their power in the areas of civic bodies, universities, the judiciary, and critically, the media.
What are the strongest parallels that you are seeing currently between what happened in Zimbabwe's GNU under Robert Mugabe and what is happening in the first months of the GNU in South Africa?
Well, I've been quite impressed by what I've seen. The parallels are that I've seen DA ministers, for example, if you look at Home Affairs, it appears as if a lot of the backlog in applications has been dealt with. That's very impressive. And I'm not so sure about education, because although I think if I'm correct, the pass rate might have gone up, you still have a very low pass level. So it's hard at this stage, and it's too early, quite frankly, to comment how well people are doing. I read a story, I think last week, where it was clarified that DA ministers were not taking new vehicles, that they simply took over old vehicles, and all of that is to be commended. But there's quite a long way to go. Yet it is important that they maintain that standard. The public are tired, I think, of the huge cavalcades, the huge entourages, the luxurious standard. This is certainly the case in Zimbabwe, and I suspect it's the case in South Africa, where ministers get into these positions and suddenly their lifestyle transforms dramatically. It's critical that the DA guards against that so that they retain the goodwill of the electorate. And it's a real opportunity for them to give a different example to the electorate. I often use the example of when I once met the Danish foreign minister in Copenhagen, and he arrived at his meeting with me on a bicycle. Now, it might be difficult going on a bicycle in the center of Pretoria or Cape Town, but the principle is the same. And one often sees these Scandinavian ministers that catch public transport. Now, I'm not a socialist. I'm not advocating that. But I think that what has to be conveyed to the electorate is that DA and IFP ministers understand the notion of servant leadership, that they are there to serve, not to be served. And that needs to be a constant theme throughout their time in office.
Meanwhile, what do you make of former President Jacob Zuma's NKP? How big a threat do you think that party could be to the GNU?
I don't see it as a major threat as long as the GNU works and delivers to the South African people. I think if the good start is continued and the South African economy is stabilized and starts to grow again, if you attract investment, if you tackle crime, if the position regarding Eskom continues, if you can spend more money on health and education and housing in particular and start to deliver by improving the standards, that will negate any threat from MK and Jacob Zuma. But if the DA, the IFP lapse into this notion that they hold these positions as of right and that they don't have to deliver, then they will become very vulnerable to the populism of MK and the EFF to a lesser extent.
Now, there are people who feel that since the Democratic Alliance and other parties have gone into government, that they are not standing up for the issues they used to fight for before, and that voters voted them in to fight for. I don't know if you've noticed that. They are not as outspoken on many key issues.
Well, that is something that we obviously experienced and were criticized for during the Zimbabwean GNU. And I found it personally. You're in cabinet with Mugabe, with Mnangagwa and other people. You're meeting them weekly. You're trying to develop a personal relationship with people so that you can get things done. And inevitably, that results in less strident criticism. I found that applied to me. And it is this balancing act. There do need to be certain red lines where it needs to be spelt out in private, not in public, but within the context of the GNU, that you advise your partners in the GNU that you will seek to be positive and productive. But if certain red lines are crossed, they need to understand that will then result in public criticism. And there's no manual for this. You just got to learn through it, and there inevitably will be mistakes made along the way, and the GNU will be threatened at particular junctures. But it needs a mature approach, both from the leadership of all the parties to understand that it is inevitable that there will be times in the GNU when pressures rise, when issues come in where there's not a consensus and there's going to be a public difference of opinion. And so long as it's not fundamental, let me use, for example, foreign policy. It seems to me that the DA in particular has major disagreements with the ANC on certain foreign policy issues. Let's take Ukraine, for example. President Ramaphosa has spoken to Putin. He's tried to toe a very much a middle line on Ukraine, whereas the DA has been strident in its criticism against Putin. And that could be a source of conflict going forward. What I said in my article published recently is that the DA needs to approach issues like that with considerable savvy. It needs to decide which are the most important foreign policy issues. And in my own view, and perhaps I'm biased and being a bit parochial, but I think that foreign policy issues around SADC are actually far more important than, for example, more distant foreign policy issues like Gaza and Ukraine. Let's take, for example, the Mozambique election and President Ramaphosa's attendance yesterday. You know, I think that that is an issue that needs to be a red line. And it's an issue that the DA can tackle more effectively without being accused of being neo-imperialists or neo-colonialists. It's an issue that affects Africa and particularly Southern Africa. But in my view, it's a critical issue because I think that the future of democracy in South Africa is largely going to be dependent on what happens in SADC. SADC is inching towards a more democratic order. We've seen that in Zambia. We've seen it in Botswana. We've seen it in the Namibian election. And even what is happening in Mozambique at present is an indication of a new mood in Southern Africa. Now, it's a nascent mood. It can be snuffed out. But it is critical because my view is that long-term sustainable economic development in South Africa and indeed the whole of SADC is dependent upon SADC embracing democracy, tolerance, respect for the rule of law. And those issues are far more important in my view than, for example, Ukraine and Gaza. And surely it must be easier within the context of South Africa to get a broad consensus involving the ANC, the IFP, the DA, and other democratic parties in terms of where SADC is headed, to ensure that, for example, South Africa in its foreign policy demands that neighboring countries' constitutions are respected in the electoral process. And then if we look, for example, at the SADC tribunal, which ZANU-PF managed to dispense with over a decade ago, and the South African government basically looked the other way. That is a critically important institution for South Africa, but for the whole of SADC, so that where the judiciaries in other countries are perhaps biased, lacking independence, citizens can have the right of appeal to a SADC tribunal. There was a broad consensus in SADC when it was first set up, and I think that there are issues like that the DA can tackle fairly effectively to pursue a strong foreign policy agenda without actually breaking the GNU.
Thank you. That was David Coulthard, a former minister in Robert Mugabe's Government of National Unity, sharing the lessons learned in Zimbabwe with former opposition parties currently in South Africa's Government of National Unity. Thank you, Mr. Coulthard.
Thank you, Chris.